This is an ABC podcast. This is the WA Country Hour with Belinda Varischetti on ABC Radio WA.
Good afternoon. How are you today? Good to have you along. This hour, the Australian Energy Infrastructure Commissioner says he's working to make sure farmers are not responsible for the decommissioning of wind turbines or solar farms on their properties, because right now there isn't a lot of clarity around those responsibilities. We'll look at that shortly here on the Country Hour. And we'll also see how the Rams were selling at the Esperance Ram sale on Friday afternoon. We got a little bit of a taste of it. We did cross to the sale Friday afternoon, but that was mid-sale, so we'll take a good look at those prices shortly here on the Country Hour. 12:06 on the ABC right across Western Australia, streaming live on the web and on the ABC Listen app. Well, in the last sort of 4 to 6 weeks, there's been a significant increase in the number of WA sheep heading to the eastern states. Deep Herd is apparently going to be releasing official figures for August a little later this week, but anecdotally, WA producers are taking advantage of the prices on offer from eastern states feedlotters and some processors who are desperate for supplies. Dean Hubbard is the head of markets with Agora Livestock, a WA-based national livestock information service. Dean, how much interstate interest is there for WA sheep right now?
There's certainly been significant interest, but in my experience at the moment, it's driven largely by what's going on in South Australia and a lack of ongoing supply in South Australia. So a lot of the demand is driven by, SA.
All right. So, and when you say it's been driven by South Australia, is it coming from which particular part of the supply chain?
Feedlots. Yep, feedlots and to some extent processors and some agency networks.
And Dean, what in particular are they looking for?
Well, up until now, it's been feeder lamb, as in old seasons feeder lamb, to go into a feedlot. Old seasons finished prime lamb to go straight to a processing works, mutton to go straight to processing. Now, looking forward, it's more the feeder lamb to go into the feedlots. So that's what we're currently experiencing and have been the last, month or 6 weeks. There's been significant interest from majority South Australian feedlotters and feeders looking to source and secure supplies over the coming months.
And that's just because there's nothing available in South Australia?
My understanding is that there's limited availability, and given the season they've been experiencing, there'll be a lack of weight, a lack of numbers. It all points to, significant interest out of South Australia to maintain the numbers that they would normally process or have been processing, which is not too dissimilar to WA.
So what sort of numbers then? The demand is there. What sort of numbers are in demand, and what's actually gone east at this point?
So, to estimate what is going east now forward is pure speculation. But what we can look at is numbers that have already gone. We can see that already numbers that have been going to South Australia, we can only see numbers through to the end of July, but those numbers indicate that we're actually behind levels of 2024. We're behind the five-year average. So up until the end of July, numbers weren't huge by comparison on previous years. And bearing in mind, we've been selling sheep to the eastern states for a long time, so this is nothing new. I would suspect that once we get August figures, which should come through the next few days, I would expect to see a ramping up in August. We expect reasonable numbers or significant numbers September, October, November. But bearing in mind, up until the end of July, we're well behind the five-year average and well behind 2024.
But for this time of year then, once we get those August figures, September figures come through, would you expect that to be an increase on what we've seen in previous years for this time of year?
I would. I would expect August will show us an increase compared to previous years. Normally, August is pretty quiet. when it becomes going to the east, and we don't see much of a ramping up until the later spring months, so September, October, November are normally our bigger months when we look to the east, and that's been the pattern. I would suspect that August will see significant increase on previous years, with a number of old seasons lambs going direct into processing or feedlotting and some level of mutton going to processing.
What sort of pressure is this putting on WA markets then, from a processor's perspective to the feedlots and the live sheep trade, which is about to start up again after the moratorium?
As far as pressure, I think most people by habit that book into our local processing in WA would have continued to do that, and there'll be spring bookings, and you would expect there is normally a spring flush. We haven't seen that as yet. Numbers are just starting to come in now. So you would expect that hopefully our local processors, and bearing in mind the number of days they're actually processing at the moment, aren't aligned with last year. So the days they're processing currently, or the numbers, the throughput is actually significant below where it was last year. So they're already starting to realign with supply expectations. So yeah, I think that that's a consideration at the moment, is just where the processors' demand's going to be. I was just interestingly looking at cattle volumes the other day, and you can see that there's been a backing off of the sheep and lamb, not so much the sheep, but more so the lamb processing numbers through July, August, and cattle numbers have ramped up by comparison. So is that a sign of, you know, the lambs are hitting a peak in price, or is it a sign, you know, that people are processors are turning more to a cattle product, which is probably a little bit, tending a little bit easier to sell at the moment, given the prices?
Well, sheep processor and exporter V&V Walsh was offering forward contracts for August and September at $10.20 a kilo for premium heavy lambs. And we heard from V&V Walsh, I think it was just last week, saying that there was very little interest in those contracts, and they could basically, the company could basically count the amount of contracts that have been signed on two hands. But producers are keen to send their sheep east. Why is that?
I wouldn't say that producers are keen to send their sheep east. It's just that the prices that have been bandied about the last month, and bearing in mind we've got local feedlotters that have also been, you know, active within the market and paying, you know, similar pricing, so, but it's just the level of pricing that we've seen the last month or 6 weeks. It's been very, very hard for producers that normally would look at offloading October, November, December as, you know, an unfinished lamb. Those prices have been very, very hard to walk past, and there's been a reluctance or a level of reluctance locally to meet the prices. So that's why there's been so many written, and it's all anecdotal, but there's been significant numbers written to the east for those September, October, November periods.
And what sort of prices are on offer?
Well, the last few weeks, I mean, you know, prices are one thing, but I mean, feeder lamb has been around that sort of round figures, $4.40 to a high of $4.60 a kilo live weight, which is, you know, it translates to very good money in everyone's language.
It's nowhere near the $10.20 a kilo, though, that's on offer in the local market.
No, but we look at this, it's more so new seasons, Belinda, and, you know, the weights they're talking at, you know, 33, 4, 5, 6 kilos, you know, they're not the sort of lambs that, you know, are going to, that Walsh's want to sign up to put into their, you know, finished trade lamb grid. You know, that they're looking more of a, you know, to get into those weights, which is all our processes, you know, we need another probably 10, 12, 15 kilos, and people just want to take advantage of, you know, that market. So that's where they've been.
So they're not, the producers aren't prepared to wait, put a few more kilos on and take advantage of that. They're jumping now and sending east.
Oh, I think they're not so much about the weight today. It's more about the prices that were being offered. You know, if you look at history, that would tell us that, you know, there's an opportunity to lock in prices at, you know, significantly high periods. You know, they're probably the best prices we've ever seen for lamb. And to be able to lock in a similar price today for, you know, October, November, December, it's been pretty attractive.
And how economical is it for those buyers in the east then?
Well, like most buyers, I would suspect, not suspect, but, you know, they're well versed in pricing, and they'll know, you know, what they're getting out the other end. So that, you know, they're not high risk takers. They look to secure a forward price, you know, for their out. So, you know, the, most of them that are buying at, you know, those prices, I would expect they'll be reasonably well covered the other end.
And how long could this go? Because you've been saying, you know, you can see that demand there through until sort of, you know, November into December, into the new year. Is it going to continue?
Well, I think there's been significant numbers written into that period. Now, whether the next few weeks, I would expect that being a forward product, they'll probably only want to cover a certain percentage of their, you know, total buy. Now, I would suspect they're getting reasonably close to their requirement for that portion of their buy to be covered. So you could expect that, you know, demand, whether it's price or whether it's demand, will probably just back off a little bit over the next few weeks, and there'll be some readjusting and some, you know, manoeuvring going on to, you know, rest assured, you know, if these are, you know, the highest prices we've ever seen, you'd be pretty keen as a buyer to try and, you know, pull the prices back if you can.
Just to sum up for us, Dean, what do you make of this period in the sheep industry? How do you describe it?
I think it's been a perfect storm, really, for the producers. You know, they've done it hard the last 2 to 3 years, as have many people. And just with, you know, it's been Adelaide, South Australia's had a terrible, you know, run of seasonal conditions. And it's just with a lack of supply out of WA and with a lack of supply in South Australia, it's just all roads point to, you know, have pointed to where we are today. Just going forward, you know, how that looks, yeah, time will tell.
Really good to get your thoughts. Thank you, Dean.
Thanks, Belinda.
Dean Hubbard, who's head of markets with Agora Livestock, and talking about the demand for WA sheep coming from interstate, well, namely out of South Australia and predominantly by the feedlotters, but also some processors as well, who are desperate to get their hands on some numbers, some sheep numbers, 17 past 12. Well, staying with sheep, because the Esperance ram sale was held in the state's southeast on Friday with 316 rams from 6 studs going under the hammer. The annual event brings together most of the region's studs in one shed, and it's a good indicator of local demand for both terminal and merino sires. Nutrien auctioneer James Cullerton says optimism has well and truly returned to the sheep industry.
Yeah, no, really good. I think the flow of the sale between all vendors really flowed on with competition, and, you know, the presentation of the stock was pretty awesome, and it's good example and a credit to the vendors, because it just shows a great example for the industry. And, you know, it's positive time in the industry at the moment, and it really certainly reflected that in today's market.
Yeah, I think a couple over 5,000, one over 6.
Yeah. No, it was hands flying everywhere with the bidding, and didn't know, my neck was breaking going left and right and everywhere else. But, like I said before, it was really good competition. So, you know, that's all you ask at a ram sale. Yeah, it's a good start to the season, and, yeah, it's really good to see.
The top price paid for a ram was $6,200 and belonged to Wattledale stud. Wattledale principal Dave Vandenberg says he can't complain.
Yeah, fairly happy. I think, I mean, there is a reduced number of ewes in the district, so it sort of depends on people's requirements, but they paid very well for the top sheep, and, well, we passed a few in, but that's to be expected.
What were clearance rates like?
Generally, they were fairly good. I think we passed in 15 or 16 or something, so, which is probably more than normal.
What do you reckon the reason behind that was?
Oh, I guess pretty good selection of rams, and people were able to be very picky, really. So the top rams sold really well, and anything that had wasn't as good probably passed in.
Your top ram sold for over 6 grand. That must be nice.
That was a bit of a surprise, because I wasn't expecting that, but going back to look at it, it is a very nice-looking ram.
Average-wise, were you happy with how things turned out, and what was it like in relation to other years?
Oh, I think our average is up a little bit, but we probably passed in a few more, but that just comes down to the amount of buyers, really.
The buyers who are left, they're obviously wanting some rams. Are you surprised that there was the demand that there was?
Look, I think demand was about where I thought. Some people come in and bought more than I expected, and some people just didn't turn up. But as I said, the ones that had specific details, good figures, they sold very well. It's just going to take a little while to for the ewe numbers to catch up back to where the, you know, for the demand for all the rams from previous years.
So what do you do in the meantime as a stud breeder, as a ram breeder? What do you do?
I think we just carry on and we assess, you know, what sold really well and what didn't, and maybe you know, put more weight on that selection pressure. The current lamb drop is fantastic, so there's going to be some pretty specky sheep come up next year, so I guess we'll tackle that. Wool is finally starting to move. I think lamb and mutton is going to stay pretty good for quite a number of years, so I think we just have to hang in there and ride it as it comes.
Wattledale Principal Dave Vandenberg speaking to Tara DeLandgraft at the Esperance Ram Sale on Friday, 21 past 12.
You're part of the Country Hour with Belinda Varaschetti on ABC Local Radio WA.
Australian Energy Infrastructure Commissioner is working to make sure that farmers are not responsible for the decommissioning of wind turbines or solar farms on their properties. It comes as tensions continue to flare among some regional communities who are concerned about the pace of the renewable energy transition. Australian Energy Infrastructure Commissioner Tony Maher told Josh Becker there's a lot of room to improve the way companies work with rural communities.
The community engagement and community benefit sharing needs to change significantly. Been on the road a lot lately and still the community isn't being engaged well enough. They're not being informed. They're not being respected. The information flow isn't coming quickly enough and in a way that's being able to be absorbed. And we also need better community value. We actually need, you know, long-term lasting benefits for the community if in fact they are going to be hosting this infrastructure that's going to be around for decades and decades.
In your mind, is the pace of the energy transition going too fast and leaving farmers and communities behind?
Well, I think there does need to be a certainty. So I think that it's been happening for a while. I suspect it's going to quicken up, but that shouldn't mean the responses and the engagement and the commitment from everyone, and I mean, you know, state governments and Commonwealth and the energy industry should keep pace with that. This is a collective thing. And I think that's perhaps one of the things that is missing here is that this needs to be done in a really collective, comprehensive way. It can't be just one party pushing ahead and leaving the rest of the stakeholders behind.
New South Wales farmers have some concerns that were raised by the former commissioner who said it might cost a landholder more to decommission the turbines left on your farm than the revenue that you generate. Should farmers be worried about being left to fund the decommissioning of these energy projects on their properties?
Well, there should be a system in place that they, so they're not worried. And I'm working on, you know, positions and policy statements right now to actually say, to mirror, you know, that what the New South Wales farmers and other farm groups have put out there. The landholder shouldn't be liable for decommissioning and looking after these products at end of life. There has to be a product stewardship scheme put in place. And importantly, an appropriate financial instrument, whatever that is, bonds or the like, that mean the landholder and the community isn't held responsible for this infrastructure. And that is an equitable arrangement. You know, this has to be, keep talking about equity. If that was to happen, then it would give the community more confidence around the implementation of this infrastructure.
So at the moment, they could be liable?
Well, it depends on, you know, the different circumstances and contracts. There are this is the point, right? It needs to be clarified and it needs to be categoric that the landholder has no liability, or if in fact there is a landholder out there that wants the liability, that wants to own the turbines and panels, then if that ever happened, then it's very clear. Right now, there's not enough clarity on it.
One of the concerns I've heard from farmers is that maybe there's a structural problem here with the rollout, in that some of these companies are like a mining company buying an exploration license with the hope of one day selling it on to a big company later on. So companies are lodging plans for wind projects, looking to get through the approval process to one day sell on to the AGLs and Origins of the world. But these developers are a company with like 3 employees and 6 wind projects. You know, how would a company like that be expected to be any good at consulting with farmers and communities?
Well, if they're going to enter into the process, then they have to have, you know, a level of capability. And importantly, the government has rightly, as a result of the previous commissioner's report, developed a developer rating scheme. And things like decommissioning need to be included in that, and the capability of capacity of the developers, the generators, the prospectors need to be covered in that process. Now, I've been supportive of that, but I'm going to hold it accountable. I'm skeptically supportive of it. This probably not going to be a silver bullet, but it is definitely a step in the right direction in terms of making sure that the companies, whether they're prospectors or generators or wholesalers, are good citizens, you know, and have the right things in place, right governance structures and right financial accountability so that the community has confidence. So that will be a good step in the right direction, and it has to include things like decommissioning.
How far off is that developer rating scheme?
It's being piloted. It was announced a couple of weeks ago that there's a company called Equifax that is actually going to run it. It's got good support from the companies, the energy companies. So it's being piloted right now. And my understanding is that the first quarter next year, it'll actually be implemented. So that's a good thing, right? This is, you know, government realising there's a problem and putting in place a measure, a developer rating scheme that'll hopefully address some of the concerns. But we all need to make sure that it does what it says it's going to do.
Yeah, so if a developer's rated with, what, 2 stars or 1 star, what happens then?
Well, people can choose if that choice is there for them to do, and that's a whole other decision that'll indicate whether they are in effect a good corporate citizen or a good industry player, and if they don't get the right star rating or tick, whatever it is, then they won't be getting business.
You've also said that many people don't understand why this transition is happening. In your mind, whose fault is that?
I think it's everyone's. You know, this is one of those jobs that people think it's someone else's job. Well, it's everyone's job. I think we have to circle back and keep reminding people this is a transition. You know, we built an energy system 100 or 150 years ago or more. The world has changed, and we need to adapt and make sure that people understand why this is happening, why, you know, when it's happening, who's doing it, who's responsible. The state responsibility is planning, but the community doesn't quite understand, you know, that process. So we've got to just keep talking to people, keep listening, and keep trying to answer their questions. But we actually do have to keep talking about this energy transition. It's too important not to keep talking to people about why this is happening.
Australian Energy Infrastructure Commissioner Tony Marr speaking to Josh Becker. 28 past 12 here on the Country Hour. Ali Colvin in the studio with the news headlines.
Thanks, Belinda. The Premier, Roger Cook, is set to introduce legislation to Parliament this week that would allow him to fast-track approvals for projects he deems a priority. The State Development Bill would overhaul the current framework to give the Coordinator General and the Premier the power to streamline significant projects. A WA judge has found police acted unlawfully but for a noble cause when they pulled over a motorist near the South Australian border and discovered drugs in the vehicle. Police stopped a man on Eyre Highway in 2023 and allegedly discovered packages containing prohibited drugs. He was charged, but the charges were later dropped because the officers pulled over and searched the vehicle without reasonable suspicion. Erin Patterson will spend at least 33 years behind bars for murdering 3 relatives and trying to kill a fourth with beef Wellington laced with death cap mushrooms. A Supreme Court judge has imposed a life sentence for the 2023 murders of Erin Patterson's in-laws, Don and Gail Patterson, and Gail Patterson's sister, Heather Wilkinson. The judge described the crimes as an enormous betrayal. Thanks, Belinda. More news at 1.
Ali, thank you for the update. Appreciate that. It's 29 past 12 here on the Country Hour, and I just wanted to give you an update on the situation at the Kwinana Grain Terminal. Industrial action at the terminal has come to a temporary 2-week halt following a meeting that was held on Friday. The CBH Group says it met with representatives from the WA branches of the Maritime Union of Australia and also the Electrical Trades Union for a formal bargaining meeting. All parties then attended a conciliation conference with the Fair Work Commission on Friday afternoon. Now, the result of those meetings is a two-week period where all industrial action on both sides is temporarily suspended, and there will be regular bargaining meetings over the next couple of weeks. CBH Chief People Officer Jackie Connolly says, "We appreciate this has been a difficult time, and we continue to work for a resolution with our plant operators and maintenance employees and the unions for a fair and reasonable agreement to be in place as soon as possible." 12:30 here on the Country Hour, between now and the news at 1. We'll take a look at this. Well, it looks a bit like a vacuum cleaner, apparently, but Deepherd's been trialling this new way of cleaning commercial vessels and testing them for potential biosecurity risks at the ports. And it's all done underwater without having to get the ships or the vessels out of the water to do the job as you normally do. So we'll take a look at that shortly, and also heading to Mushay for the results of the cattle market. In just a moment, heading to the Bureau of Meteorology. To one here on the Country on the ABC right across Western Australia. Let's make our way now to the Bureau of Meteorology, and Caroline Crowe is with you this afternoon. Caroline, a lot of rain across a great part of the Southwest Land Division over the weekend, and I'll get to those figures shortly. What can we see for this week?
Yeah, good afternoon, Belle. Slightly different this week than what we experienced on the weekend. We're on an easing trend when it comes to showers, and we're really going to be looking at a lot quieter conditions as a ridge pushes through and generally bringing clearer, sunnier skies to most parts of the Southwest Land Division. Bell, cold nights and possible frost is probably the summary of it. Today, showers are continuing along southern districts, getting into the great, pushing as far in as the Great Southern. There's a fresh southwesterly flow still along the south coast, and that's gradually going to trend more towards the south coast and gradually contract east as we progress into the next couple of days. So by Thursday, most of the showers should be out of the Southwest Land Division. Also just in the north today of the Southwest Land Division, so getting over the Central West District and maybe just creeping into parts of the Central Wheat Belt as well. There's some showers still lingering around, but sort of in between those two areas, it's generally clear at the moment, Belle. So, as the week progresses, by Thursday, generally, most of the showers will be out of the south. Well, all of the showers should be out of the Southwest Land Division, because as that ridge pushes through, we're going to start seeing the winds gradually trend more to easterly. And then by Thursday, it's more of an easterly wind regime through the Southwest Land Division, so keeping everything away. And then by Friday, the winds really start turning northerly. In the morning, they'll be moderate-ish in strength north-northeasterly, and then start tending more north-northwesterly during the day, because next weekend we've got another cold front and a vigorous westerly flow behind it. So very similar to what we've experienced this weekend is what it's looking like next weekend at this stage. In regards to temperatures, Belle, so we're on a warming trend as well. So coolest temperatures today, gradually warming during the week. So for most parts, the hottest day is going to be Friday, where the west coast parts is looking 4 to 8 degrees above average, and sort of more eastern and northeastern parts of the Southwest Land Division getting up to 2 to 4 degrees above average. So if I sort of just give you a couple of temperatures to give an idea what it's looking like, parts of the Central West District, Northampton, Geraldton, Eneabba, Kanama, all looking around that 28 degree mark, Morowa 29, Mullowa 29, and then as we go a little bit further south, most of the central wheat belt is around that 26 degrees, the Great Southern 23, 24 degrees, and then getting into the 20s along the south coast, and sort of from the Perth area is going to be around that mid-20s and getting into the low to mid-20s as well for the southwest. So quite warm, or getting warm by Friday, and from an overnight temperature perspective, tomorrow morning out of the next couple of days looks as though it's probably the coldest, still cold on the other days, but coming into Tuesday morning, temperatures getting 0 to 1 degrees in many places. Narrogin's forecast to be 1 degrees, Brookton 1 degrees, Caliberon and Cunderdon 0 degrees, so quite cold. So we could see some widespread frosts, and then that still potential for Wednesday morning and Thursday morning as well, though temperatures may be a couple of degrees warmer. But by Thursday, by Friday morning, the temperatures do start to pick up a little bit because we'll see a little bit more of an increase in the winds keeping those temperatures up, Belle. But otherwise, yeah, fairly quiet over the next few days, or becoming fairly quiet with the cold front over the weekend.
And what's the outlook then for northern and eastern parts of the state?
Yeah, so for northern and eastern parts of the state, Belle, well, if I start in the south, there's still, for the Eucla, southern parts of the goldfields, just the chance of those isolated showers still with those onshore airstreams over the next couple of days, but it's really on that easing trend as well. So by Thursday, showers will be confined towards the Eucla coast, and then nothing, no rainfall expected on the Friday. Winds will be similar as well with what I described for the Southwest Land Division, so getting trending more of an easterly and then northeasterly by Friday for those southeastern part, so the goldfields, the Eucla, and also the south interior. Cold nights, so Tuesday and Wednesday and into Thursday mornings as well, we could see some frost through parts of the southern Gascoyne and getting into the goldfields as well, very similar to the Southwest Land Division. And a little bit further north, Belle, we've got an easterly surge happening, so until the end of the week, those winds are going to be east to southeasterly and quite fresh and gusty through northern parts of the state. So that includes the southern parts of the Kimberley, the north interior, and getting right into the Pilbara and northern parts of the Gascoyne. Mostly sunny conditions through those areas. Although, Belle, we are starting to see a couple of isolated showers and thunderstorms through the Kimberley. So yesterday there was a couple of showers lingering around, very light and not really too much in them. But we are seeing hints of that activity. And then to day through the Kimberley and getting into the north interior as well, there's the chance of a shower or thunderstorm, and we've actually just seen some thunderstorms pop up around east of the Balgo Mission area in there, but not too much rainfall with it. Similar conditions for that area coming into Tuesday, but then we'll see the chance of a shower or thunderstorm becoming more confined to the northern parts of the Kimberley, Belle.
Thank you so much for all those details, Caroline. Appreciate that. 22 to 1. Let's now check the rainfall figures. So on a Monday, we look back over the weekend. It's the last 72 hours to 9 o'clock this morning is what we're looking at. We'll start in northern and eastern forecast districts and check 5 millimetres and over. In the Gascoyne, Bulardi 9, Bulga Downs had 5 over 4 days, Kerry Downs 9, Carnarvon Airport 7, Carnarvon 12, Challa 8, Q6, Mount Gibson 5, Mount Narrier 7, Ningen Station 19, Payne's Find 12, Steep Point 7, Ewan 10. Then in the Goldfields, Kalgoorlie Boulder Airport had 6 and Norseman Aero had 10. Now, a lot of rain in the Southwest Land Division. Starting in the Central West, let's check 30 mils and over. Alanuka 57, Arena 34, Arradale 38, Barberton East 31, Ballandane 34. Canna had between 25 and 31, Canterbury 30, Chapman Valley 55, Coolangatta 29 to 30, Eridu 30, Arangi Springs 45. Geraldton had between 26 and 36 at some different sites. Green Grove 30 over 4 days. Jurien Bay 37. Lancelin Defence 39. Mingenew 31. Moaska 42. Nabawar 46. Nambung Station 36. New Norcia 37. Strawberry 48. Tabletop 44. Wallabing 30. Warradarge East 35 and Wundi 40. Then in the Lower West, 30 and above, Anketell 47, Bickley 65, Bindoon 48, Bungendore 55, Chidlow 39, Dwelling Up 52, same for Gidgegan Up 52 in the gauge, Gingin had between 22 and 59, Gleneagle 49, Jandakot Aero 63, Jarrodale 44, well, actually, 36 to 44 at Jarrodale, Julimar Forest 46, Carnot 49, Carrigullen North 48, Lake Chittering 42, Lancelin East 23, Mandra 37, Millenden 45, Minston Park 51, Mullibini 60, Moondah Brook 57, Mount Solis 39, Mouche 62, Mundaring 58, Pierce RAF Base 65, the Perth Metro had 55, Pinjarra 36 to 49, Serpentine 38, Tamala Park 56, Waroona 40, Werribee 50, Whiteman Park 64, and Woodridge Estate 44. Moving to the southwest and 30 and above again, Bailing Up 42, Beetle Up 49, Bridgetown 34, Brunswick Junction 34 to 39, Cape Lewin 44, Cape Naturalist 34, Carlotta 62, Chapman Hill 36, Collie had 32, but that was over 5 days. Kawaram up 41, Darden up had between 30 and 35, Donnybrook 35, Ferguson Valley had between 31 and 33, Four Acres 50, Harvey 37, Jarrawood 32, Jindong 50, Carriedale 35, Manjimup had between 55 and 64, Main up south 34, Mount William 45, Nanup between 50 and 61, Newbercup 40, Northcliff 81, Pemberton 67, Perivale Orchard 38, Quinnanup 70, Ravenscliff Alert 40, Rosabrook 38, Scott River 44, Shannon 77, Tonebridge 51, Walpole Forestry 63, Warner Glen 33, Willyabra 47, Windy Harbour 85, Worsley Downs 36, and Yanmar 63. Now let's move into southern coastal areas and we'll check 10 mils and above. Albany 51 to 70, Amalup 39, Beaumont West 11, Bremer Bay 13, Chesalon 19, Chain Beach 47, Chillinup 21, Denbarker 49, Denmark 59, Gardner had 10, Hopetoun between 16 and 17, Inglebourne 34, Jacob 21, Kimberley 38, King River 79, Many Peaks 18, Mount Barker 53, Munglinup had between 10 and 13, Narrakup West 56, Nyrilup 13, Ongerup between 5 and 16, Ravensthorpe 15, Stirling South 29, Tamar 50, Tallina Downs 10, and the Duke 13. Into the central wheat belt, checking 10 mils of rain and above, Amory Acres 13, Ardeth 14, Babbican 15, Balladoo 18, Beacon Aero 14, Belka East 10, Ben Cubbin had between 10 and 12, Beverley 13, Bonnie Doon 15, Bonnie Rock 12, Bullfinch 15, Buntine West 26, Burrakin 14, Burrakoppin South 18, Cadoo 11, Kalgi 21, Kodgkodgin 11, Kalkaring 12, Cunderdon Airfield 15, Dalwallinu 23, Dungan Peak 11, Ejanding had 12, Gabon 10, Happy Valley 13, Jeroma 12, Caliberon 11, Cocodine 17, Condit 14, Conongoring 12, Quarter Arrow 11, Long Forest 17, Meckering North 14, Meriden had between 13 and 14, Monongarran 16, Moraine Rock 20, Mount Hardy 11, Mount Noddy 14, Mount Walker 11, Mount Westdale 17, Muresk 22, Northam 16 to 19, Quadney 22, Quiriding 17 to 18, Redlands 20, Shackleton 10, Southern Cross Airfield 20, Talloning Hill, 10. Training, 10. Training West, 10. Wheal, 13. Wongan Hills had between 4 and 17. Nattering, 16. York, 16. And York East, 23. And we'll finish up in the Great Southern, looking at 10 and above. Badgerbup, 15. Boddington North, 21. Burralee, 12. Boscobel, 21. Brookton, 16. Bulli, 15. Chamming Up, 29. Cherry Tree, 23. Coondee, 39. Quartering, 28. Corrigan had 31, and that was over 5 days. Cranbrook, 38. Cranham, 26. Culford, 30. Darkin, 24. Dragon Rocks, 21. Franklin, 36. Franklin Vineyards, 39. Glenrose, 19. Highbury East, 14. Holt Rock, 18. Hyden had between 14 and 16. Katanning had between 16 and 17. Cogenup, 27. Kendinnan Aero, 12. Cookerin, 18. Coolin, 13. Lake Grace, 18. Lake King, 12. Magenta Dam, 17. Maradong, 16. Mordetta, 18. Mount Madden East, 18. Narrogin, 16. Newdigate Research Station, 14. Nyabing had between 13 and 16. Pingerley, 20 to 22. Pingerup had between 0.4 and 14. Quail Up, 24. Riverdale, 22. Tambalup, 24. Tunney, 22. Wagen, 13. Wandering, 26. Wickapen had between 6 and 24. Wilgarra, 19. And Yillering East had 19 in the gauge.
You're part of the Country Hour with Belinda Varischetti on ABC Local Radio WA.
The Department of Primary Industries and Regional Development has been trialling a new way of cleaning commercial vessels and testing them for potential biosecurity risks at ports. The technology is designed to remove algae and other marine life from commercial vessels without having to lift them out of the water. Deep Herd Aquatic Pest Biosecurity Senior Researcher Sam Bridgewood says the tech shows potential.
What we're testing is a diver-operated underwater vacuum, which Fram Marine have developed. And it's designed to remove the biofouling off a vessel's hull. And so far, as anyone knows that works in the marine or aquatic environment, it always throws up some challenges. It's about 100 times harder than doing anything on land. But on the whole, the equipment is really promising.
Okay, so you said it's an underwater vacuum. How does it actually work?
So the divers, you have commercial divers, they hold, it's a bit long tube really, and they have different attachments and they hold it over something growing on the hull and they knock that off with some scrapers and it sucks it up, takes it up onto land and then runs it through a series of sieves to get rid of the bulk of the organisms, and then it's run through a UV radiation profile, which then you get the clean water gets sent back into the ocean.
And what sort of aquatic pests are you looking for? Which ones are the most concerning?
Oh, there's a whole suite of pests that we look for. So there's mussels, there can be oysters, there's lots of algae, there's also ascidians that we keep an eye out for as well.
And are they problematic? Like what sort of damage could they do?
Yeah, so they can overgrow things and they'll take over a whole space and they'll crowd out our endemic species. They potentially consume all of the nutrients out of the water, so there's nothing there for our endemic species as well. They can shade them out. They can grow over mussels and stop them from opening up so that they can't actually eat, basically.
And what sort of vessels are you testing this on?
At the moment, it's just restricted to commercial vessels. This has only been one trial on one of the Fremantle Port Authority's tugs so far. And assuming that everything's sort of ticking the boxes, then Fremantle Port are likely to roll out a bit more of a pilot study that we'll be involved in as well.
Okay, so if it does eventually get approved for use on a national scale, how much of a difference would this technology make to biosecurity checks in the future?
So if there is a piece of technology that's going to be able to meet the national guidelines, then it's going to make a big difference to industry in terms of being able to clean their vessels safely from a biosecurity and a chemical perspective. But it doesn't remove the need for best biosecurity practice, where biofouling should really be kept to a minimum to ensure the likelihood of harbouring a marine pest is as low as possible. So we've had something like 10,000 vessels visit WA in the last year, which is a huge number of vessels and one of the largest visitations in the whole of Australia. And any one of those vessels could harbour a marine pest somewhere on their hull.
Deep-Eared Aquatic Pest Biosecurity Senior Research Scientist Sam Bridgewood. She was speaking to Georgia Hargreaves about a new underwater vacuum that's being trialled as part of the biosecurity treks at the Fremantle Port. 10 minutes to 1. Well, around 30 agricultural science students from Murdoch University have spent the past week touring the Great Southern and learning about different innovative farming systems. This is the third year in a row the students have hit the road to visit agricultural businesses between Perth and Albany as part of a new unit which focuses on livestock production. Leah Labeur is a lecturer in animal science and joined the students on the tour, and she says lots of students are really keen to sign up for this particular unit.
Yeah, this is we're using it as a feedlot right now, but you can see that these are our confinement feed troughs. So however long they are is how many sheep can go in the pen.
So we're taking 30 students for 5 days down the Katanningen Albany Way for an industry tour, and the idea is to take them to a range of properties and animal operations, not just farms. We're also visiting an abattoir and a reproduction specialist centre to give them an overview of the industry and expose them to different practices and different opinions, but also some of the people leading the way when it comes to innovation.
Tell me in particular some of the places that you've visited, some of the farms.
Sure, we visited Hillcroft, both their ultra white operation but also the piggery. We've been to Mujip and Stud, obviously here, Glenkeith Ag. We've been to CJ Sousa, some commercial operations. We are visiting Katanning Deeperd Research Station tomorrow, but also Fletcher's Abattoirs, Genstock, from Cojonup, Stirling Ranges beef feedlot, etc.
Wow, it's a jam-packed week because it's a five-day tour?
Very much so. I think last year we covered 900 Ks in 5 days in our minibuses. So it's a very intense week, but I think we all get a lot out of it.
So tell me, where are these students from and what are they studying?
So they're all studying a Bachelor of Agricultural Science, second and third year. So this unit is an elective and can be taken either in second or in third year. We probably have 20 to 25% of them from rural backgrounds. The rest are urban and international students. But they all come from very different backgrounds and are very complementary. And it's because of that mix that this unit actually works and this tool works.
And from my understanding, this is a relatively new unit, isn't it?
Absolutely. The unit started, so this is the Livestock Career Readiness Unit. It started in 2023, at first with the support of AWI that sponsored the development of the unit. We're still in the development phase in the sense that we've increased numbers throughout the years, and we've reached the what we estimate is the cap number, which is 30, and hoping that we're at the stage where we can offer it every year for the next few years at least.
Why bring in a course like this one when there's already ag science courses that exist?
There was a need highlighted due to the cohort of students coming to Murdoch. Murdoch has a very large urban-based student cohort. It created that sense of I don't belong into the ag industry. And if you add to that the fact that a lot of them enroll in this course at first to transfer into vet, we needed to address, I guess, the need for the students to be exposed to this industry and actually get a chance to discover it from the inside rather than being daunted on the outside.
So what you're saying is a lot of these students don't necessarily come from a farm.
Absolutely. Not only they don't come from a farm, but some of them have not grown up around farming at all. And it gives them a sense that they're never going to find a job. Or if they find a job, they're just going to have imposter syndrome. The reality is ag industry is very diverse. We need diverse people. We need diverse opinions. That is the only way innovation is driven. We're trying to give them that sense that we need a bit of everything and a bit of everyone.
So when it comes to a bit of everything, that's what this week is about, really, isn't it, Leah?
100%. We're trying to show them first of all, different industries, sheep, whether it is wool, meat, feedlotting, cattle, dairy, pigs, but also some of those earth farm services, to really try and show them that there's a place for everyone and there's also a lot of opportunities off farm.
Today, because we're on a farm, what are some of the things that have been discussed and questions that they've had?
I mean, students have dazzled us with a lot of really good questions on the systems. I think a lot of them are interested in some of those novel practices, such as confinement feeding, and how this can be used as part of a system to protect the land and really help make sure that there is enough feed for certain critical times, such as lambing, but also how do we balance a crop and an animal system value add on crop by using it internally in the system.
How do you go about getting something like this together, though? I mean, you said you've had outside support, but logistically getting producers on board, how do you go about organising this trip?
We ask a lot of favours. We are lucky to have a great network as part of Murdoch. A lot of our research is on farm with sheep producers. So as part of our network, we have a lot of people who we know do some really good things, lead the way or are thinking about it a bit differently. So we basically reach out and ask kindly if they would be prepared to host us. I find that most farmers love talking about farming, especially to people who might not know as much as them. I think it's like we're very grateful.
Well, a lot of them agreed to have the students out on their properties by the sounds of it, because they really got around. Leah LaBeur, she's a lecturer with the Centre for Animal Production and Health at Murdoch University, and she was speaking to Kate Forrester about that week-long farm tour through the Great Southern, which is now in its third year, and really honing in on agricultural businesses between Perth and Albany as part of a new unit which focuses on livestock production. This is the Country Hour and it's 4 minutes to one. Let's get to the market now. And this afternoon we're off to Mushay for the results of the cattle sale. 1,381 head of cattle were penned for sale at Mushay today. So that's up 514 on last week's numbers. Terry Birkin's been at the sale today, just keeping an eye on things. Terry, hello. Can you run through all the details for us?
Hi Belinda. Supplies jumped this week at Mushay to 1381. The sale consisted mostly of local and pastoral lines of store and feeder calves drafted in large lines, filling sale pens. There were quite a few new faces amongst the regular crew of buyers looking at purchasing calves for restocking, backgrounding and feedlotting. Young steers recorded gains, as did the cow market this week. Local weaner steers lifted 50 cents, selling from 350 to 478 cents, while weaner heifers were back 10 cents, making 220 to 388 cents a kilo. Local yearling steers remained equal, with steers under 330 kg selling from 358 to 446 cents, and heavyweights from 320 to 452 cents a kilo. Yearling heifers under 330 kg sold from 220 to 402 cents and with more weight and frame returned 340 to 396 cents, easing 10 cents. Lighter frame pastoral steer calves started from 240 to 354 cents and heavier bodies from 250 to 362 cents a kilo, remaining equal. Younger pastoral heifers were also firming last week, ranging from 156 to 256 cents, for bigger framed heifers sold to a top of 342 cents a kilo. Grown steers were up slightly, making 280 to 393 cents, while grown heifers returned 238 to 390 cents a kilo. Store cows ranged from 120 to 276 cents, while medium cows returned 242 to 338 cents, and heavy cows sold to a top of 368 cents a kilo, gaining 15 to 20 cents. Plain bulls back to paddocks sold from 150 to 340 cents, depending on quality, while bulls suited for shipping made 210 to 296 cents a kilo. Local heavy bulls lifted 10 cents, ranging from 313 to 344 cents, while pastoral heavy bulls were making 240 to 330 cents a kilo. This is Terry Birkin for MLA's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Well, Terry, thank you for going through those details. It sounds like you're struggling a bit with a sore throat this afternoon. Well, I hope that improves tomorrow, because we're coming back to you tomorrow, back to Mushay for the results of the sheep sale tomorrow. And just speaking of livestock, sheep in particular, recapping our top story today, that in the last sort of 4 to 6 weeks, there's been a significant increase in the number of WA sheep heading to the eastern states. And that is because of the huge demand coming from, in particular, South Australia, from the feedlotters and also some of the processors who are desperate to get their hands on supplies. Good to talk to you today. The 1 o'clock news is next.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.